As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. And I want to welcome a gentleman I met, I don't know, a couple weeks ago. I had heard his name mentioned before, but I never had the pleasure of meeting him, and he is a candidate for the state Supreme Court. He is Judge Everett Mitchell. Good morning to you, sir. How are you?
I'm good, Mr. Ingram. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing just fine. I'm honored to have you on these airwaves. Let's talk a little bit about Judge Everett Mitchell.
Yes, sir. What you want to know, Doc?
All right. So let's talk about the fact that you've made how does one get to a point in their lives when they say, well, I think I want to become a Supreme Court justice? Let's talk about your life, the things you've done in your life that brought you to the point that you have now thrown your hat into the ring and to become Supreme Court justice.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Ingram.
Where are you originally from?
I'm originally from Fort Worth, Texas.
Fort Worth, Texas. So how does somebody from Fort Worth, Texas wind up in a cold place like Wisconsin?
Well, I will say that there are a lot of people in my life who have believed in me over the years. So I would say, I grew up the son of a single mother. I didn't meet my father until I was in my late 20s. Had experienced a lot of abuse in my life and a lot of trauma that came along with that abuse. And so, when I got ready to graduate from high school, there are kind of two interventions I think in my life that really kind of propelled me to not think my life is invisible. I was pretty much one of those kids who, because I experienced so much abuse and I was struggling with reading, I kind of checked out. And I remember getting, when I received my calling to preach in ministry, it really was this idea that I was no longer invisible. And so that was one big moment in my life that kind of gave me a moment to a different pathway that I had never thought was going to be possible to me. And then I think secondly was when I was getting ready to go to graduate from high school and didn't believe I could go to college and had accepted a job bagging groceries. And it was just receiving a call from a small school at Jarvis Christian College. And they asked me, it's like, you want to come try college? And they said something that made sense to an 18-year-old, because I was like, I got a job bagging groceries. And they were like, well, if it don't work out, you can always go back to bagging groceries. And, I failed everything, Mr. Ingram. I had like a 1.5 and two black women, two strong, beautiful black women, Miss Daisy Wilson and Miss Margaret Bell, saw me walking down the hallway looking discouraged. And they pulled me to the side and said, Everett, we don't want you to give up on your dream of going to college. So we want to teach you how to read. We want to teach you how to study. We want to teach you that discipline, what you need in order to be successful. And they taught me, take my boombox up to the library and study from 5 to 10 every day. And that discipline and their commitment and their love gave me the confidence to go from, Jarvis Christian College to transfer and get my degrees in mathematics and religion from Morehouse College. And then eventually make my way to Princeton and get my two master's degrees from Princeton, and then eventually make my way to Wisconsin.
Judge Mitchell, I just got through with the conversation with people talking about single mothers and how difficult lives they lead and how we live in a system that is so judgmental of those single mothers. And we don't offer the support and help that single mothers need in this society. It is a more than difficult undertaking that they are dealing with, and yet we as a society dismisses and points fingers and so judgmental of them. You say what?
I say that my mother was one of those women who endured hell twice before she had my sister and I. So, sometimes you have to be open to the idea that sometimes there's a reason why mothers are the way they are. and those situations end up sometimes outside of their control. And my mother wanted the best for my sister and I. But, you know, she had been abandoned by her mother at a young age, given up at birth. And then, you know, my great-grandmother, who raised my mother, died when my mother was 12 years old. And then she didn't have anywhere to go at 12. And so she ended up with one of my aunts, and her husband viciously abused my mother until she was pregnant with me at the age of 20. So, you know, you just never know, you know, what people have been through. And so my mom really was trying to create a life that that she didn't have for my sister and I, doing the best she could, working at Kmart for a lot of years. In fact, my first job was working with her at Kmart when I turned the age of 16. So, you know, I think the just mental nature is because people don't always understand the complex difficulty of what people experience in their life and the supports that some people need in order to make a difference for that next generation.
So that combination of a pastor and a judge, let's talk about that combination, because that's a highly unusual, but I think just visionary combination of two career paths. Let's talk about what that looks like.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, when I went to law school, I went to law school with the intended purpose of, you know, being a career prosecutor. And when my congregation lost their pastor, congregation I pastor now, when they lost their pastor, he was a good friend of mine. And so really the goal was, you know, I'm still have my job as prosecutor, but I could also do this other job as well to kind of help my congregation find a new pastor. Well, they wanted me to stay on, and, you know, that's almost 13 years later. But when I became a judge, the fear was, you know, the establishment clause between separation church and state, was I going to use my religion to help indoctrinate people or to rule from the bench? And I reminded those who were concerned about that. I said, well, you know, you don't go to other, you know, other skin judges and ask them to get not go to Rotary or to not be involved in certain groups. You don't say that. I said, those groups are exclusive. I said, at a minimum, I can say my congregation is open and involving, and anybody can come. I said, all the difference is, you know my values. You know what I stand for, and those things don't influence how I see the law, but they do inform how I treat people, how I treat individuals who come into my court, and the manner in which I think we should be treating individuals who we find traumatized in traumatized states and victims who are victimized by crime. So they don't clash with each other. If anything, they run on very unique parallels, where on one side I can work within a system that I'm trying to say, all right, it's not fair, it's not just, how do we make the court system more fair, more just? And then on the opposite side, I'm asking a very different but similar question, how do I keep my congregation and therefore community and their children and grandchildren out of this system because it is not fair?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Both at the same time. Yeah, so I'm just doing both at the same time.
So right now, are you in children's court?
I am the presiding judge of our juvenile division in Dane County, yes. I want to make sure your listeners also understand that in Dane County, as a presiding judge of juvenile division, I do see CHIPS and juvenile delinquency cases, but I also see civil cases, family law cases, which involve divorces, child support, termination of parental rights. And then I also do probate, small claims, and I run a high-risk drug court program for Dane County.
So let's talk about the children's court, because right now, clearly there are children in the society that face some situations that early in their lives that put them in situations that will change their lives and change the trajectory of what will happen in their lives forever at very young ages, and the crimes that many young people are committing in, and the answers that we hear from people is lock them up, throw away the key, They're stealing cars. Lock them up forever. They're doing this. Lock them up forever. What do you say to people who are so quick to say that a young person who's made mistakes early on in their lives should be basically locked up forever?
I would say that I understand, because there's a need for accountability when people are hurt. My perspective has been, because I work with men and women who came out of prison, and I created these programs for adults coming out of prison, that when I became a judge, I became uniquely aware of where they said the problems were for them. And they always talked about when their first time was in juvenile court, like foster care, right, like being removed from home and those kind of. So I would say to those individuals that when we think about, if we're trying to ultimately not have individuals locked up, we need to make, or victims, we need to make sure that we're targeting our interventions so that we are not passing traumatized children from one system to the next, which is what we currently do both in Dane County and I suspect throughout the rest of our state. So what I would say is that we have to address trauma, and we have to make sure that we give language to trauma and that we give direct interventions when a child is home. When I couldn't get any help, Brother Ingram, from academics or, people, because I was coming out talking about, if we really want to stop this move toward adult criminal behavior, which is, to me, creating more victims, we need to go back to talking about the child welfare, to juvenile delinquency, to adult prison pipeline. And when I couldn't get that help, I went to a filmmaker to create a documentary called Not Enough Apologies, Trauma Stories, that was featured on Wisconsin Public Television. And in that case, one of my young people was so courageous to allow us to film him in court and film his life and what he had been through. And the stuff that this boy had been through was just, it was heartbreaking.
So Judge Mitchell, hang on a second. We've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. My guest is the Honorable Judge Everett Mitchell. He is a candidate for the State Supreme Court. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back to the Early Grip Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. My guest is the Honorable Judge Everett Mitchell, and he is a candidate for the State Supreme Court. And before we went to break, Judge Mitchell, you were actually talking about what was it? I'm sorry.
The documentary.
Yeah, the documentary. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a documentary called Not Enough Apologies, Trauma Stories. And it was one that really talked about trauma-informed care throughout our state. But really what it was me bringing cameras into the courtroom so that the public could see what I was seeing on a daily basis and how broken I felt our system was, and these young people that we were just not giving the direct treatment that they needed, and then acting surprised that they were ended up stealing cars.
So when you talk about the treatment that they needed, give us a short synopsis of what some of these young children who came before you was happening in their lives that brought them to that point.
So I make sure that your listeners always know that they have to give in their minds, they have to get a framework of child welfare, which is foster care. And when children are brought into foster care, or when they have to be removed from their home, that is a level of trauma that many people don't understand. And so we're talking about movement. And they say one movement is traumatic. Some of our young people have multiple movements, sometimes moving back into family care, moving them back out of family care, moving them to one foster home to the next, moving them to a group home, taking them out of a group home, back to a foster home, from a foster home, back to a treatment facility, back to their home, out of their home, wow. back to... So by the time some of these young people, Brother Ingram, have even gotten to the age of 12 years old, they have been moved at least 15 to 20 times. And so in that continuum of a child's life, you can imagine how traumatic that span of time is. And so we weren't even giving children treatment to address how to handle the moves. Right? There's no direct treatment.
Right.
And so there were a lot of times, Brother Ingram, where I would have to almost threaten to bring people into court just to get people appointments. Because kids were like, we'll get them in 3 to 6 months. I mean, that's too much in the life of a child. And so, so that's one of the things that we had to, I had to do real quickly was, sign a contract with a provider of color that could go in, provide therapy services, provide in-home services, because a lot of these young people were not being ordered any services, even though we knew that they had been pulled out of home for abuse or neglect.
You put together not only the documentary, but you certainly have done your due diligence and put together sheer informational packets about the depth of what has happened with these children. And so when, unlike most judges who that I've known who deal with, and I'm not saying they don't have any compassion, but who deal with what happened, what the child did, and basically ignore what created that environment of why a child did what they did. The crime supersedes, does the crime that they committed supersede all of those things that led up to the crime? Do we totally just dismiss, what happened in the child's developmental stages and just go to the crime itself? And because there are people who say the rest of that doesn't matter, we just need to lock them up.
Yeah, see, the statute that governs child welfare and the statute that governs juvenile delinquency doesn't say that. It gives us 7 things we're supposed to consider when we think about young people. And we're supposed to think about the crime and the victims, but we're also supposed to consider what are the things that we need in order to come up with the best dispositional option so that the children are more likely to gain the competency to be successful and not reoffend. So we can't just ask the one question about, what did you do? But we also have to ask the question of how did you get here? And if we're talking about how you got here, how do we make sure that you have what you need so that you don't end up in a further situation that hurts more people long term? So that's what the statute tells us to do. So if any judge is not doing that, in many ways they're in violation of the statute that governs how we're supposed to think about these cases. And it starts out right up front in 938, right up front in Chapter 48 of the Children's and Juvenile Justice Codes.
Judge Mitchell, there clearly is a difference with a juvenile and an adult, and that's why they're two separate systems of judgment. Is that correct?
They're totally different. I would say that, yes, I would say they somewhat look similar, but they're two totally different systems. And it's just unfortunate that the majority of the public really has no knowledge about how the juvenile justice system looks like.
And so that's why it's so easy to point the finger and say somebody stole a car, lock them up forever, right? They're driving reckless, lock them up forever. But the judicial system is a little more shrewd than the average citizen. And so when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about that. Our phone lines are open at 844-967. If you, too, want to join in the conversation with Justice Everett Mitchell, he is a candidate for Wisconsin State Supreme Court. I'm honored to have him on the line. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. My guest is the Honorable Everett Mitchell, Judge Everett Mitchell. He is running for the state Supreme Court here in Wisconsin. And, you know, Judge Mitchell, it was important that I think people who hear you for the first time get to know who you are. We're going to have you on again, and we'll talk about perspectives, you know, on the state level and all those things. But I think the background and some of the things that you've done long before aspiring to become a state Supreme Court justice are critically important to people understanding just who you are. Now, you know, you talked about the fact that these children that you have really kind of spearheaded transforming the way things are looked at, the documentation that you put together to really point out to people just what has been going on, I think is so critically important. Let's talk about some of that documentation and why you put that in writing so people can see a more vivid picture of what's taking place.
Yeah, I think, you know, since that was my first time coming to Community Brainstorm, I've been giving these talks about changing the system for the last 5 years throughout our state. And so, you know, I was kind of surprised that many of the great leaders at the Community Brainstorm had not been presented with this information. So I wanted to make sure that you had a, you know, physical document that kind of talks about my philosophy that I've instituted here in Dane County that allows for us to kind of change the narrative of success while also keeping our community safe. So, you know, so for example, I told everyone at the Community Brainstorm in Dane County, you know, we have went from 4 judges down to 3 judges because we no longer have the cases to justify the bodies being in court. And we have reduced our, you know, juvenile cartel referrals almost to a degree. I think we had like 6 in October. We didn't have any in November, and we haven't had any referrals in December. So, you know, the process of working together with community leaders, law enforcement, churches, parents, kids, it makes a huge difference so that kids do not think of themselves as needing to go steal cars as a life option. Right, we're taking that off the table, and we're saying here are 15 other things you can do that we will support you in doing, but stealing cars or you know, sexually assaulting young women or you know, using gun violence, gunplay, you don't have to do none of that stuff because these are the things that we're now going to help you get. Because, and then I tell the kids, I tell them exactly where I came from. I'm honest with them. I'm like, listen. You're smarter than me. You have more skills than I had when I was your age. I couldn't even read, so I knew I was struggling. I said, but you're smarter than I am. And I think a lot of the kids feel that honesty and they feel that passion, and it gives them at least some assurances that as long as I'm on that bench, that I'm going to make sure that they get exactly what they need and they won't get hurt.
You use the verbiage life option. I don't think people really conceive of children looking at those things as life options.
They do. That is because they don't have any other option. I mean, the biggest thing I talk about a lot And I talk a lot about because the only way I came through my trauma, I may not have been able to read, but man, I could, you know, I knew math, I could do chemistry, I could do those other things. So what I recognize is that if a kid does not have education, and we can come on and have a whole conversation about shortened school days and how, you know, kids who with IEPs and young black, brown, and white children were being placed in shortened school days, which means that they were only going to school for 1.5 to 2 hours a day. That's it.
So what is that? Because I don't think people can conceive of what that even happens. What is that?
A shortened school day is when a building determines that a child cannot be in the building, and so they only allow them in the building for maybe 1.5 to 2 hours a day for education programming, and then they release them. They're just out in the street.
Is that because of some trouble that the kid has gotten into that they can only be in the building for that period of time?
Maybe. But sometimes it is because whoever's in the building don't want to deal with that child. And this is never to demean educators, because I know educators have a very difficult job. But children who have IEPs, individualized education programming, they're not, federal law doesn't allow for us to only give them 1.5, 2 hour a day programming just because their behavior is a problem. You know, we're supposed to make sure that they have resources, because that money comes with their IEP. How do we utilize the resources, right? So in order to keep them in school, you might need to get them a mentor. You might need to go contract with 100 black men or contract with some churches. Or you have to be proactive to get them the supports that they need so they could be in the building, be successful, and eventually get their education. But if I'm telling you about England, they literally were having 1 hour to 2 hours a day, and then there was no other educational program. None. And then you're going to ask me to say, what option will they have?
So let me ask you, because by law, and correct me if I'm wrong, the education of children, that there's a law that says your public schools have to educate these children. How do they get around that?
They are quote unquote educating them, because they're giving them some educational program. But, you know, nobody pays attention to the idea of the fact, you know, this is what caught my attention. Well, you know, when I had a young girl in my courtroom and she had stole a car at 11 a.m. And I was like, well, girl, why are you not in school?
Right.
How are you stealing a car at 11 a.m.? And she was just like, Judge, they won't let me come to school. And I thought, you know, I have this idea of listening to kids. I thought she was lying to me. So I told her, I said, listen, I'm going to call this vice principal right now. And if they tell me, you know, you lying, you not going to school, we're going to have some issues between you and I. She's like, whatever, Judge, I'm telling you, they won't let me go to school. Lo and behold, Brother Ingram, I call the vice principal. I'm on the record in court. And this dude tells me she can't come back to school, and they won't let her back into school. I'm like, how am I supposed to change the dynamics of her life if she's not being allowed to access her education? So that's when I started asking more of my kids, like, well, you know, they were stealing cars. I'm like, why are you stealing cars? Where are you at? How long are you in school? 1.5, 2 hours a day at max, 2 hours. Some of them weren't even in the school. Some of them were at libraries somewhere, over at a community center somewhere, and they may get some worksheets, but they weren't getting programming. And I'm thinking, Lord Jesus, what in the world is happening? If we don't get them at least some education, and they are not going to be successful.
So you use the term change the dynamics of their lives, and I think probably people who are listening here are probably saying, hey, wait a minute, you're a judge, they're in court, this shouldn't be about changing the dynamics of their lives, this should be about punishment. You say what to that?
I say that's not what the statute tells us to do. If you follow the statute in both 938 and chapter 48, there are 7 factors that we're supposed to consider. And in those 7 factors, one of the factors is what we're supposed to do in terms of punishment. But the other factors also make us have to go into this a little bit deeper than just, you know, we're trying to come up with a dispositional option so that they develop the competency so that they can live a life that is free of crime. So we're trying to figure out how do we develop that competency in them. And I'm saying to the social workers and the education partners, if they don't even have an education, I can't even begin to help them develop the competency to be successful.
Go ahead, sir. Do you then, with your colleagues, have they bought into what it is you are saying, or is it that only through the luck of the draw does a juvenile get to go before Justice Everett Mitchell, Judge Everett Mitchell, as opposed to, you know, Judge Cutter Boston?
Yeah, no, all of my colleagues, you know, we bought into this idea because it's been working, right? It is working. You know, we still have some, you know, some kids that have very difficult lives to sort out. A lot of mental health, a lot of trauma, lack of education. So we're trying to sort those things out. But at the end of the day, all of us are on the same page. And so we use our collective resources to make sure that our kids don't get lost. So one of the things I did, Brother Ingram, is that I work with the school district here in Madison to create this thing called an Office of Youth Engagement. So we created a specific office to connect the court system with our educational system so that no child is lost in our process, right? They have a, you know, a robust staff with the Office of Youth Engagement. The new superintendent has funded that so that every child that is coming through our system is also flagged through the system. And that office is there to support the families, the foster parents, the guardians who are working with our young people in our system so that they don't lose that consistency and that continuity of care in their educational process. That was one of my biggest gifts to our community, to go fight for that to be started and to be funded so that, you know, our kids don't fall through the cracks.
Judge Mitchell, people will say, well, you know, that's a much smaller population that he's dealing with in Madison. So, you know, you can kind of control that. But let's try to put that, you know, into Milwaukee public schools where there's 70,000 children. Are you confident that process could work even in a system as large as Milwaukee public schools?
So I think the issue that most people who say that have, I say yes, Madison is a smaller population. I said, but Milwaukee has more resources and more people. If I had the amount of resources in Milwaukee, you have more elected leaders in Milwaukee, you have more churches, you have more Greek organizations, you have more leaders, you have a community brainstorm. I don't even have that. You know,
right.
You can pull together resources that if they got together and aligned themselves with the court system, along with the school system, I mean, it wouldn't matter. You may have 70,000 kids in Milwaukee, but maybe about 10,000 of those kids maybe might end up in the system. Of those kids who end up in the system, you could basically get one Milwaukee treetop person to be a mentor to each family and dramatically change and transform the entire juvenile justice system. You would shut it down. Milwaukee can literally shut down the juvenile justice system because it is the main feeder of bodies to our
adults. You know, Judge Mitchell, you've got it figured out because, again, as long as people are going to look at it from the perspective of these are criminals, this is the criminal justice system, and so this is what we do. Our justice system is to punish people, and I don't care if they're children. It's to punish them, and which is short-sighted when you're talking about children who are going to grow up and become adults. If people can't see that it's best to turn around and the possibilities of turning around, you know, wayward children is better done when they're young as opposed to, you know, waiting until they get to a point where they've given up, then we get what we're dealing with now, right?
Yep.
I mean, I'm sorry.
That's it. And that's what I mean. That is why we get what we get. It is it has not changed our dynamics. And I will say that the leadership we've had in Madison and Dane County has changed our dynamic in a very significant way.
Hang on, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. Judge Everett Mitchell, he is a candidate for the state Supreme Court. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. What say you? We'll be right back. You can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. My guest is the Honorable Judge Everett Mitchell, and he is a candidate for the state Supreme Court. You know, Judge Mitchell, I've only known you a short time, man, but I feel like I've known you forever, because you have the gift of being able to see things as they can be, and not just to see things as they are, and because you've been able to and have that gift, and I think that's the part of the minister in you that I was talking about earlier, that lets you see that person as a human being. And listen, we can transform and change these young people. And that's got to be the way we look at it, because long term, for all the people who want to see us continue to lock young people up, the amount of money that it costs, let's talk a little bit about the amount of money that it costs to lock a child up for an extended period of time.
Right now, the Department of Corrections charges $1,154 a day to lock up a child, and that's around $421,000 a year.
A 10-year-old that's locked up, it's costing $400,000 a year.
If you lock them up in a place like Lincoln Hills, then yes, they're charging $1,154 a day right now, to a total of $421,000 a year.
Go ahead.
Think about that. Just think about that. I mean, the counties are going to have to pay for that. The parents will have to be, you know, some form of reimbursement to that. I mean, that is a significant expense when you think about, you know, what we're doing and how we're investing in bodies.
So this whole answer to lock them up, and I always say to people, because I spent the last 12 years in the public school system in a volunteer capacity, and I would always say to people who would say lock them up, you don't have any idea at all of what it is you are talking about. You know, because if your answer you think is to lock up all these young people who've been traumatized, Judge, and you know, we need more police. And if you think those are the answers, the sheer numbers of children who've been traumatized, continue to be traumatized as we live in a society and a system that basically devalues them. They live in war zones. You're not going to ever have enough money to build enough jails to lock up these people, right?
But think about this, Brother Ingram, and this is what made me pay attention to how I do things systemically. When I went to go visit Lincoln Hills, and, you know, they've done some reforms over the years, but when I went to go visit Lincoln Hills, there was two things I noticed. And this is a story I tell here in Dane County a lot. I went and I saw the young men whose hair was just all over the place. And I went and I talked. I pulled one of the young brothers aside. I said, "Yo, dog man, why are your hair looking like that?" And he said, "Man, you ain't gonna believe me, Judge." I said, "No, man, holler at me. Tell me why your hair looking like that, because you can't go to court looking like that. You're gonna look crazy." And he said, "Dog," he said, "if I'm being 100 with you, Judge, listen, I ain't trying to complain because I ain't trying to get no trouble, but they don't cut lines. They don't do straight lines in our hair. The lady wants to do curves in our hair." I said, "Curves?" I said, "Wow, that's crazy, man." And they said, "Man, she's a dog groomer, too."
Wow.
Now, I want you to understand that, but, to your listeners, I want your listeners to understand that the symbolism of having a dog groomer cut circles in young black boys' head, you know, leaves them with the impression that they are. And then the second part was, I went to go see, you know, I would say I wanted to see where are you housing these young people? Where's your solitary confinement? And the administrator at the time said, "Oh, we don't have solitary confinement. We call it restrictive housing." I said, "Well, I don't care what you call it. I need to go see it." And so I'm walking through the restrictive housing areas where they got young boys in there locked down 23 out of 24 hours a day. And it sounded like a dog kennel. It was the most painful thing I had ever experienced in my entire life.
Judge Mitchell. Young boys locked down 23 hours a day?
22 to 23 hours a day. It was horrible.
Yeah. You know, and this conversation that you and I are having right now is one of what'll be, I hope, many conversations as you move towards, you know, running for this office. But and so we focused on children today. There's so many other components of things that are wrong, I think, with our state Supreme Court, right? And uh-huh. I've watched it and witnessed it move towards a conservative court. And uh-huh. I've always been told that, you know, the court should not be, you know, either conservative or liberal. That shouldn't be any of that. But yet we hear that this is a conservative Supreme Court. And they certainly govern. Even the federal Supreme Court governs from a conservative bent. But I thought that party lines were not supposed to even be involved in this.
You're right. I think what people struggle with is even if you separate the partisanship, there's always an ideology that people have related to how they interpret the law.
Right.
And so it's the ideology of how people bring these, what they bring to the law that's not clear. So when, you know, I think a lot of people who think about Supreme Courts, they think about case law, they think about precedent, they think things are subtle. And what I've often told them, I said, what you're finding this space of whether it's conservative or liberal, the ideologies, is that it's in that discretionary moment of how they choose to interpret facts. And that is where you're looking at the values of people first. I think when we went through the last round, the Supreme Court justices, and they all got up, and they said things like, well, I believe, you know, Roe is the precedent of the land. I believe Roe is the precedent. I believe Roe is the precedent. Well, when they said that, people didn't recognize that just because something is precedent doesn't mean it is final. And as an African American judge who studies the law, who teaches a class at the law school here in Madison, I can tell you that, you know, we are not in a place of equality if there was not an overturning of precedent. Brown versus the Board of Education, which you know so well, was overturning a standard of separate but equal. So, because